everybody. Welcome. Thank you for coming. My name is Professor Sandra Guerra Thompson. I'm a professor here at the University of Houston, and I'm the director of the Criminal Justice Institute, and it's my pleasure and honor to introduce our speaker for today, Mr. Donald J. DeGabriel, Jr., who is the United States Attorney for the Southern District of Texas. Mr. DeGabriel was sworn in on March 17th of 2006 and became the 21st presidentially appointed United States Attorney for the Southern District of Texas. President George W. Bush nominated Mr. DeGabriel to serve as United States Attorney for the district on February 13th on the recommendation of Senators John Cornyn and Kay Bailey Hutchinson. The full Senate unanimously confirmed his appointment on March 13th of that year. Mr. DeGabriel currently serves on the Attorney General's Advisory Committee. He chairs the Border and Immigration Law Enforcement Subcommittee, and he serves on the Terrorism and National Security Subcommittee and the Regional Law Enforcement Information Sharing Working Group. Prior to his appointment as the district's United States Attorney, he served the district as the first Assistant United States Attorney since 2002, and he has a total of 24 years of federal law enforcement service, including 3 years as a special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Mr. DeGabriel began his service as an Assistant United States Attorney in 1986 in this district's head office in Houston. He's prosecuted a variety of significant federal cases, including public corruption, white-collar crime, bank fraud, violent crime, and criminal organizations involved in the trafficking of narcotics and human beings. He has also served as the chief of the criminal division, supervising the prosecutorial efforts of the assistant U.S. attorneys. Given his extensive prosecutorial experience, the Department of Justice has called on him to share his legal knowledge and expertise with others. He has been frequently invited to participate in training conferences and seminars throughout the United States, presenting lectures on a variety of legal topics and issues to criminal law enforcement officers and prosecutors. He also has the distinction of being one of a very select few who are chosen to serve as resident legal advisor to the South African National Directorate of Public Prosecutions. So he's done some international work as well. During his career as a federal prosecutor, he has successfully prosecuted a number of significant federal cases, resulting in his being recognized for his outstanding and superior performance with numerous letters of commendation from the FBI, DEA, ATF, and INS, and the prestigious Department of Justice's Director's Award for Superior Performance by an Assistant United States Attorney. Before joining the office, Mr. DeGabriel was an Assistant District Attorney for the Orleans Parish District Attorney's Office in New Orleans, Louisiana, where he rose to the position of Chief of Trials. He also practiced in the private sector, working as an associate attorney with an admiralty law firm in New Orleans. He's a native of Lake Charles, Louisiana, a graduate of McNeese State University with a BA in Humanities and a law degree from Louisiana State University Law Center in Baton Rouge. Please join me in welcoming Don DeGabriel.
Don't anybody say a word about LSU, okay? I'm not in the mood to relive what happened Saturday down in the swamp. Gosh, with a resume like that, most of which was made up, incidentally. Nowadays, you can just throw anything there. And I said, Sandy promised to read it no matter what. It can only be downhill. So I'll try to do my very best to live up to some of those expectations that you might have from having heard those words. And I am so glad to be back in law school. I've missed it so much, and I did not mean a single word I just said. So for those of you that find yourself saying, this kind of sucks, maybe just a little bit, it's a lot of work, that was me in the day, and if I can come back for things like this, that's good. But in a minute, I guess now, I'm going to lose my jacket, if that's okay with y'all. Can I take this off because it's a little toasty in here? I normally wouldn't do that, but with your permission, I shall. We are one of the most robust districts in the country. There are 94 United States Attorney's offices throughout the country. We have four here in Texas: Southern, Eastern, Northern, and Western. And among those 94, generally speaking, year in and year out, we file more felony charging instruments than anybody in the country. And even though by size, you know, Houston's the fourth largest city, we're the fifth largest in the numbers of assistant United States attorneys that can prosecute cases on behalf of the U.S. here. We've had 172 right now, and that makes us like number five in size, but we make up for it in our numbers. And one of the reasons that our numbers are what they are is because of the immigration problems that face all of the country, but particularly the Southern District of Texas. I don't have it here in the slide, but our offices go from Laredo down the river to McAllen, thence to Brownsville, up to Corpus Christi. So those are all staffed offices that I have. And the work that they do, particularly in those four offices, is because of the immigration problem that we have. And we do every kind, and you're going to hear, I'll show you statistics, and your eyes may glaze over a little bit, but hopefully at the lecture's end, you will have an idea of the kind of numbers that we face and why we file so many cases. Pretty much immigration and drug cases form roughly 4/5 of what we do, so roughly 80% or so of our cases in that number that I told you deal with immigration and drugs. And we can be very informal if you feel like asking a question when you see it. We're not going to wait till the end, and then, you know, if you have a question, so the minute something pops into your head, share it with me. I guess you do it at your own peril with Sandy here, because she's taking notes, and will share with your professors, I suppose, at some point hereafter. All right. Mm-hmm. Okay. This is what I hope to go over with you, kind of let you see some of the statutes that we use, what are some of the penalties, and they'll be self-explanatory. I'm generally speaking, and call me on it, not one of the people that likes to read to you what you see up here on the PowerPoint. I'll kind of talk around it and through it, and hopefully won't be too guilty of doing that, because I don't think it's that helpful. But, and then, of course, I told you I'll show you what the numbers are. But the, okay. Here is an old statistic. You'll see as I go through the slide that things have changed, and I'll give you fiscal 06 and 07 numbers. But just then, 4.5 million illegal aliens were apprehended across the border. And those are ones that they caught and actually sent back. So either they were deported or prosecuted or whatever, but that many went back. And that 350,000 figure you see, or these are people that were apprehended and they turned out to already have U.S. criminal histories, convictions of one felony or another. People want to get into this country, and they're willing to risk their lives and their safety to do so. I've got a couple of pictures here to show you of cases that we've prosecuted. Yes?
I'm sorry, when you say 350,000 with criminal records, U.S. criminal records, does that include the crime of being found in the U.S. after a previous deportation? Or
yes, if they have a prior 1326, a federal felony, it includes that, yes. Can't see very well. Maybe we could. Can we dim this bank of lights, or do they all go off? It's easier for people to sleep if the lights are off. I'm going to show you a few slides of the lengths to which people will go. This lady was in between the firewall of a pickup truck and the dash. Had been there for, as best we could tell, a couple of hours, because it takes a long time to get across through the bridges in Laredo, and people wait in line, and it's always pretty much hot down in Laredo. And this woman was at least in there for 2.5, maybe 3 hours. The engine's running most of this time. Now, granted, the firewall is back behind her, but it's been stripped out, and she's lucky that she's alive. This individual was pretty clever. He wasn't seen exactly like that. He had the fold over his head, and then the arm, I guess it gives new meaning to head and armrests, right? And, you know, they figured out that, you know, he shouldn't have been here. This is a trunk. In between the trunk itself and the back seat, a little compartment that's no more than 2.5 feet wide, and there are four people in there. There is a mother, a child, and two other juveniles. I wanted to give you a snapshot of what it is that we face with our smuggling problem. This was just the month of May, and we found truckloads of this many aliens. You're going to see a photo later of the case that we had down in Refugio, Texas, where 19 people died in the back of a pickup truck, and that's May 14th of 2003. We've since prosecuted three different criminal organizations, including the truck driver, Tyrone Williams, which you may have recalled some publicity about. He received life in prison for having driven that truck, knowing that they were in the back and hearing them banging and not doing anything about it. We'd originally charged him with capital murder, but the jury came back and said that life imprisonment was suitable, and I think that was a fair resolution of the case. These were some of the truckloads of people that I told you about in that earlier slide in May. I can't see it so well. I apologize for that. Here's another one. Literally, they'll get as many people as they can get in, and whether it's hot or cold, whether the refrigeration unit is on or not, people will run great risks to get here into the country illegally. This was the case I told you about in May of 2003, where 19 people lost their lives because they suffocated and literally boiled to death. Their blood overheated and they died. What's the statutory scheme that we use? I don't know, how many of you have already taken some criminal law and are familiar generally with Title 8 of the United States Code? That's where most of our immigration-related prosecutions come in, except as you'll see in a moment for hostage taking or kidnapping. And believe it or not, smuggling people is so lucrative that other organizations will attempt to steal loads of people from a different organization. There's competition, just like in the drug wars. And because it's so profitable and because we've got so many people now along the border and it's harder to get people in, when you get a group of people through, they're usually held somewhere in a halfway house or someplace here, often in Houston, until they pay their ransom money or what they call their transportation costs for getting into the country. And people will steal loads of people and raise the amounts. And what a perfect captive audience, because, you know, what are they going to do? Run away? And they're threatened either with being put into forced labor or left there because it's not like they can go anyplace else and get help. So they're the ideal victims when it comes to this sort of criminal activity. Nevertheless, 1324 is the rubric that deals with transporting, harboring, concealing those that are here in the country illegally. It's a federal felony. Those are the elements of the statute. These are the things we have to prove when we charge an alien smuggling individual. And primarily, we charge organizations of people, a group of people that are responsible for the... I apologize if you guys can't see. If y'all want to come, there's two seats right up here. I've just blocked your view, didn't I? You were hoping I wouldn't say that. Okay. You can still see over. Anyway, we try to charge organizations. So generally speaking, when we file charges in smuggling, we do more than, say, just the driver or just the coyote that brought the people across. We try to make a case, find out who they dealt with in Mexico, and we go after organizations. So when you see, like, that picture of the car that had the four people in the back seat and the one driver, we ended up not charging that. That person, they were all deported and sent back to Mexico. We don't prosecute everybody that we find here illegally, with an exception that I will show you in just a minute down in Laredo. Here are just more aspects of that same 1324 rubric. That knowing or in reckless disregard becomes important. In other words, we can't just... a person, like, for example, if you read the newspaper today, I think it was in today's news, on 59 near Gessner, a truck driver was pulled over for traffic violations, and when the police pulled him over, they heard a male voice screaming inside, right behind the where the passenger cab would have been in a storage compartment, the trunk of a semi. And of course, the driver and his passenger said that's the first time they'd heard anything, didn't know anything about who was in the back, and there were two people there, an 18-year-old and a 55-year-old man who was already dead from suffocation. And that was just in today's paper. Now, in a case like that, if we had the driver, if we can prove that he knew that they were there, then that would be a perfect candidate for charging here. And because of the death that ensued, that person would be looking at life imprisonment. If, however, as is their story that they've told thus far, and I'm not telling you anything that's not public, they had no idea that there were two people back there. They must have sneaked in at some point on their trip up from Mexico. The two individuals, the deceased individual, the 55-year-old man and the 18-year-old, were both from Mexico. The driver and the passenger, were Cuban. Right now, that case is just kind of starting out. And so we would have to prove that they knew that they were back there. And if we can't do that, and it's possible people can sneak into trucks and hide out in places, then we wouldn't be able to charge that particular offense. Tyrone Williams was much different because people were, as he was driving down the highway, he stopped a couple of times and told them to quit banging. They stuck their hands out through the lights, and at one point he stopped to get them water. So, you know, that was sort of a no-brainer. This is how we get the work done, not only at the checkpoints. How many of you have been down to South Texas and gone through a checkpoint at some point in your life? Okay, so you know that generally there, the main question they ask you is, are you a U.S. citizen? And sometimes I don't know why it's the devil in me. I go, okay, okay. And they kind of laugh at me, and then I have to be careful with that because it's not like I know all those guys. You know, they might not see the humor in that. But nevertheless, that's where you establish. And we get a lot of our cases naturally from checkpoints, but also these roving patrols and then ongoing investigations, like people that are... we know that somebody has been smuggled here. They're being held against their will now because they've paid what they thought they paid, and finally they get a call out. We'll do an investigation, like I said, to get to the organizations to find out who's responsible. These are our typical cases. I just told you about that, the transporting, catching people at the checkpoint, and then people in these safe or halfway houses where they are actually staged before they get sent out to wherever it is they're coming into the United States for. Those are some of the penalties. For commercial or financial gain, that's an element that we can prove, and it jumps up from 5 years to a 10-year offense. And seldom do we get, we've never charged a humanitarian case, somebody that they picked up somebody on the road, taken somebody to a hospital, to a church, and we have those. We have enough business doing where people are doing a straight, here's how much it costs to get you into the country, here's how much it costs to transport you, and we'll keep you here until you can pay us. Yes?
What's the standard for stopping and roving control? Is it reasonable suspicion?
Well, no, as long as you're within about 50 miles of the border, the Supreme Court has already said that those are considered the equivalent of checkpoints, so they can just, on a hunch, stop the vehicle because it looks like it's loaded down maybe in the back. I mean, they don't have the luxury of time to do whimsical stops of people and hope that they catch somebody. It'll be somebody driving erratically, looking suspicious, another car following it, heavy weight in the vehicle, that kind of thing. Yes, sir?
Are these truck drivers
Okay, and most won't get life unless somebody dies or gets seriously bodily injury. Like Tyrone Williams was an independent trucker. He was moving grocery loads and dairy products between New York and San Antonio, actually. And a lot of these independent truckers don't like to go back empty. And a lot of people that are engaged in transporting aliens are smuggling them into the country know that they don't want to go with an empty truck back, so they will literally go troll the truck stops and look for independent drivers and say, hey, you want to make some more money? Generally speaking, it's going to be people, because they don't, the drug cartels won't trust that kind of, peradventure with their dope, but they will trust with people, and Tyrone Williams is exactly what happened. He had gotten a phone call from a previous guy that had talked to him a couple of months earlier on a load that he brought down and said, hey, we've got some people we'd like for you to move. You want to come down here? So he drops off his cabbage and watermelon and milk in San Antonio at a grocery chain, heads down to McAllen in Brownsville and picks up 89 individuals from three different organizations. But we also have truck drivers that are hired by companies. And so now there has been a big push by Border Patrol and the state of Texas to go after their CDLs, their commercial driver's licenses. They'll take a chance, but in the past we haven't been doing that. But if somebody comes through, like this truck driver that had two people in the back, don't know his status, but let's say for the sake of argument that he has a commercial driver's license, but for the death, that might not have been a case that we would have taken, just because of the sheer volume. And as you saw the earlier slide, we like to have five or six people being smuggled at a time, and that keeps us very busy. But nevertheless, in lower amounts, BP, Border Patrol, asked us if we would consider prosecuting that commercial truck driver, and then assuming he gets convicted for transporting the one or the two, or harboring the one or the two, then the state of Texas will forfeit his commercial driver's license. And we're publicizing that so that otherwise legitimate truck drivers won't think it's worth that risk. You know, they've known, well, it's one or two people, what's the harm? I can say they just sneaked into the back of my truck or my trailer when I stopped at a truck stop. If they know that they're risking their license, they might think of it differently. Okay, that's what I told you about how you can get death if somebody dies or there's serious injury, and you've got that knowing knowledge element of that they were back there. Okay, just some additional penalties that we can skip through. This was the hostage taking statute I told you in Title 18 that we also have the ability to charge people just for they are trying to get their family or their friends to pay. This is a more serious statute because it carries more serious punishment, up to life or death if death ensues. But this is the most effective tool that we have against those people that steal loads from people or hold them in a place against their will until they pay. We can add this statute to the otherwise not as penalty-oriented statutes and the smuggling statutes, you know, assuming somebody has not been hurt. But this can ratchet up the time that they would be exposed to. Okay, we have a very robust Human Trafficking Rescue Alliance here where we have partnered with Catholic Charities, the YMCA, and as I often say when I talk pretty much to anybody, the old paradigm in prosecuting and criminal investigations were that we got involved in a case, it's kind of at the end of the deal, and the police bring us something, the FBI, Border Patrol, or whatever, and then we'd make a charging decision. And that's kind of the end of the case. I guess over the last several years, we have begun to realize how we can't solve the problem ourselves, and we need to have some buy-in from the local community. And people like Catholic Charities and the YMCA get victims of human trafficking, in particular, that are working somewhere as prostitutes, as forced labor, children that are being held against their will. And in the past, they would not come to us to tell us. Remember, as I pointed out earlier, what perfect victims they are? You know, who's going to complain? Certainly not they. Well, they will go to a Catholic Charities or the YMCA, and they will find out stuff. And the fear was that we would immediately learn of their illegal presence and either, if not immediately, eventually deport them. That still is a possible end, not immediate. If there's a crime going on, we're going to figure it out and go after those that are responsible for the crime of hostage taking or human trafficking. But there are different, there's an S visa now, there's a T visa, there's a U visa. There are these separate statuses that people that we've used as material witnesses can seek presence in the United States for a while. At the end of that process, they still have to apply for citizenship like everybody else. But this sort of encourages the victims and witnesses to come forward and tell us and help us go after the people that are responsible for those crimes.
Do you very often, my understanding with the SBCI is that it's basically up to the government to give it. It's not like something that you can affirmatively apply for, like a TV visa and a U visa. How often, I am an immigration practitioner and have a lot of, so how often, I've not heard of people who got S visas. How often do you do that?
They're limited. I would guess in the past year, if there were more than 500 granted nationwide, then that would be, will it come back on if I just do this? It says to no one in particular. The projector. Any IT gurus in here? So to answer your question, not as many as you might think, because they're hard to get. They have to prove that
they're... I've never seen one, so I didn't think it was bad.
Well, no, we have you on a list of people to not give S visas, so you can tell your clients. We have special lawyers that we... I'm just kidding. That's a joke. Do not. And this is being recorded, so you were all my witnesses. That was a retraction. And they're limited by administrative. I think there's a CFR that addresses each of those.
So there are criteria that are used, because I've known of cases that, to me, should have qualified for that, but I've never seen anyone ever be offered it.
Yes, now they're rare, but it's... What we do then, short of that, is we will declare somebody, and that was what the next slide was going to be, a material witness, meaning we need them to continue the investigation, and should the case ever go to trial and thence to sentencing, those would be people that we need to get information from. And as long as we've declared that, that what happens is they'll get released on a bond, but most, we've got a very successful rate of keeping those material witnesses here without them, you know, disappearing into the middle of the heartland. Most stay around through the prosecutions and then hope that somehow they can get an S visa or a different type visa. Or if nothing else, they go back and, you know, either they'll come back again or they have to apply legally to get here. I think we lost the projector. That's what happened. So are we getting somebody? Okay.
S visa for the victim?
An S visa can be for anybody that's here illegally that has information that they want a protected status that the government, because we sign off on these, they've come to us. The immigration court can issue them, but they want us to say that we agree that this person should be here because they're instrumental in a criminal investigation. It can be a drug smuggling case, anything.
It's also known as the snitch visa.
The S visa, that's why we called it that. Yes.
Talking from the point of view of the victim who is being given an S visa, if at the end of the prosecution use of him or her, he's given an S visa and has to go back, what if he fears death at the hands of the Lord? Can he consent to an asylum application?
Yes. Generally speaking, though, those that are bona fide asylum requests, and we get a bunch of them, and we know the countries where that's really a risk. I mean, for somebody to say, no, I can't go back to Mexico, they'll torture me because they found out that I was here illegally or I was transporting. That won't happen, and that carries a little weight with the government in deciding. But somebody that, say, wants to go back to maybe Iraq or Iran, they might have a case.
What I'm saying is that if on the other side he's seen as a snitch, having told the details of where he came from, sending him back after the S visa, what is there for him?
Well, if somebody gives information against somebody, we don't award, generally speaking, just because you're afraid that the organization back there might find out what you're doing, that you cooperated. Generally speaking, I mean, they will find out through a grapevine, I guess, if their load of dope or people got taken away. I have not seen many requests on "I'm fearful just because I cooperated with the government" cases. Academically, it sounds like something good to talk about, but I just haven't seen that many. So it's not beyond the pale to say that it could be considered. I'm just it has been very unlikely, or it just hasn't happened much.
But you couldn't support an asylum application, right? Because this would be private. You're hearing private violence.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, that technically, but I'm saying given some other status to say, I want to go back, give me another form. Asylum has to deal with governments only, and that the government will do something. Yeah, I'm sorry if I wasn't clear, but that was a good follow-up. Okay, anything? Okay. All right. Let's see. We were, like I said, we were talking about material witnesses. They, you know, they'll get a bond, and sometimes they can make the bond, sometimes they don't. There's a detention facility up off of the Beltway up near the Bush Intercontinental Airport.
Export Plaza.
The what?
Export Plaza.
There you go. I'm sure you've been there a few times, probably. The projector went off. I don't
know. Plug back in.
I know I talk with my hands, but my feet?
It's the placement of the...
No, I'm sure I did knock into it. I'll be very careful this time. No, it's my fault. Thank you. Let's take a little while to warm up. Okay, let's see. I think I have a slide coming up on the kind of the trial issues that we find. And winning these cases, particularly in South Texas, is not very easy. In other words, you know, almost always the most common defense of a case that doesn't plead out, obviously, but somebody that wants to go to trial, is that I had no idea that they were in my fill-in-the-blank truck, trunk, trailer that I'm pulling. And, you know, we have to show that they were. Okay. Let's see. Yeah. I'm sure I did that too. Or that we'll get a sort of a humanitarian defense that may not be valid, and they'll say, well, I wasn't doing this for money. I was just doing it to, I guess that's the most common stories, just giving them a ride. They were hitchhiking, and I happened to be heading up to San Antonio or Houston, and I just wanted to give them a ride. And unless we get some information from the people that are being transported, we can't charge that case. So traditionally, we will talk and interview each of those that are in the vehicle or the conveyance, talk to them separately, and find out what was going on.
So those cases really are hard to whip?
Well, because, a lot of times people will say it'll be a truck driver is the most common difficult one to prove. That will say, I stopped at a truck stop like I always do, got something to eat, took a shower, slept in my cab. And those 5, 10, 15, 20, whatever, 55 people just got in the back while I was there at the truck stop. Now, one way that we can sort of preach or myth that defense is that most trucks that are at least transporting, if they're not empty, are transporting something, and that's what happens a lot. They'll have a load of anything, tractors, watermelon, cabbage, name any produce, and then behind the legitimate load will be the people or the drugs on the other side. They have to be sealed. The trailers have to be sealed by customs, and there's a sealed customs seal on there, and until they get to where they're going, it gets unsealed, and they have to report that. So if we find a sealed truck, that actually makes it easier for us to make the case, because we say there's no way that seal got put on there until after you already loaded it on the other side, usually, and therefore that helps make our case. But if there's no seal, or if it's been tampered with, perfect defense to say, hey, you know, somebody broke the seal and that's how they got in there. So.
If they have 55 people there, they're not going to say it was humanitarian.
They have not. I have, you know, I doubt. You know, now there's some concern in the Congress that we needed to have a statute, the government did, to say you, if somebody is coming in to go to church or go to the hospital, that they were afraid that we were charging, making those charging decisions throughout the country, and no one was. It's, I mean, that was, you know, if that was the case, they get a pass. And we fought against passing legislation as being unnecessary and as being tampering with the charging prerogatives. It's a judgment call, but they were convinced, and the legislation has since died. That was last year. All right, those are the penalties. We've been there. Yes?
How involved would you say your office is with federal and state legislation in terms of providing the feedback you just described? And is it welcomed by legislators?
We're not involved with state legislation at all or seldom. But with federal legislation, we, in fact, I've got a conference call at 2 o'clock to talk about a bill that the Congress wants to pass regarding worksite enforcement and to go in and make it a crime for a law enforcement, you know, Customs and Border Protection or ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement agent, to go in and if they detain anybody for more than 48 hours that's not a citizen, I mean that is a citizen and are they got advisement of their rights, stuff that the law already provides for, and either make a charging decision or deport them if they're here illegally. Well, there's a bill that we're going to be talking about this afternoon, and this is stuck right here. Maybe this is not working. Okay, maybe this one out. I'm having a great time up here. Forfeiture provision we have. And we do forfeit things like trucks and houses, cars, conveyances, when we can prove that the facility was being used to commit these offenses. Okay, we were talking about human trafficking, and then there's a little few notes on material witnesses. Any questions on them? Here's where we were. Those are the offenses that I was talking about that we often encounter, and hence the reason for when we lose a case, it will be because one of these things happened and we didn't think that they were really doing that, and we believed in good faith that we should charge somebody, but sometimes a jury might be sympathetic to that fact. And by the way, I believe, let me get that plug in, our job is to seek justice, not to get convictions. And I believe that everybody that I've hired, I make sure they understand that. We're not about numbers, although numbers usually drive things like resources, but we don't care. We believe that there's got to be a good faith basis, that frankly, beyond reasonable doubt, almost to the point of no doubt at all, that this person committed this offense. We have a lot of power. We can ruin lives, reputations, businesses by what we do, and a careless charge of somebody is we want to protect our law licenses and we want to protect what Justice Sutherland said in the Berger case in 1935, that since we're the representative not of an ordinary party to a controversy, but of a sovereign whose duty to govern impartially is as important as its duty to govern at all. And then it goes on, and that's where the quote comes from, that we can strike hard blows, indeed should, but we're not at liberty to strike foul ones, and that we should seek justice and not seek conviction. And so I believe in that. And even though when we lose these cases down there, make no mistake that we had trained men and women, professionals, that made the charging decision and went to the grand jury to get the charges filed. You saw in one of the 1324 that you can increase the statute 1324 for reckless endangerment. And that is, again, sorry for the bad picture, but there are 15 people in the back of this pickup truck that was stopped going about 85 miles an hour or so through the brush just north of Laredo. Fortunately, they finally stopped them, but you can see how easy that would be for somebody to have popped out of that truck to hit a ravine or something and
that that was a case of reckless endangerment. All right. Okay. Something about numbers. As you can see there, those are old, and I'm going to, next slide, we'll update this. But to give you an example, these were just alien smuggling cases in 94 that were filed nationwide. You see 678 total out of all 94 U.S. attorney's offices. And then I said 94. Roughly 10 years later, that number has quadrupled. And then the year thereafter, another couple of hundred. In our district, those are the numbers that show you how the cases have gone up. And you may have read, or maybe reading now, that apprehensions are down across the border. And they are. There are several reasons for that. One, there are just so many law enforcement people, so many Border Patrol agents and officers, that people know the chance of getting caught is greater than it has ever been, and hence choose not to come or not to risk it. Because as I mentioned at the beginning, they're risking their lives when they do some of the things they do to get into the country illegally. And then they're risking their livelihood, their liberty, because they run the risk that they'll get prosecuted for being here illegally, and I'll show you why that is in just a second. Now, those are smuggling on the top, immigration prosecutions overall in the district. Those are the numbers for the last 2 years, and you can see how drastically that has gone up. Another 500. I told you earlier, when you add in the drug cases, about 80% or thereabout is what we do. In that one snapshot that I did in fiscal year 05, 73% of the cases that we filed were immigration-related in the Southern District of Texas. Not only alien smuggling cases, hostage-taking cases, people that have been deported and re-entered the country, and people that are just here. These are all felonies. These are not the misdemeanor for just being here illegally. I'm going to show you that in just a second. But it also includes aliens that have no status that possess firearms. The firearm statutes say that convicted felons, people with documented mental history issues, people that are here under alien status of any kind cannot legally, lawfully possess a firearm. This number down here, I just got the phone call because we were working on how many cases as a whole that we have filed here, and the number is 5,580. Cases that were filed in all of fiscal 07 in the Southern District of Texas. That made us number two that year, behind Western District of Texas, who is usually the district that, you know, we usually one or two in cases. But I just wanted to point out here that if you added all the criminal cases that were filed in these three judicial circuits, including all the districts that are in there, I mean, there's some very populous districts there, we have charged more than those three circuits and the district offices therein. Can we turn that light on, Sandy, or please?
Do you have a question?
Yeah, sorry.
I was just curious if you know any other districts in Texas if that proportion is about the same, about 75% of cases?
It is for Western, probably not as much for Eastern or Northern. We just get such a sheer crush of cases from those checkpoints and the borders. And that segues right into the what we're doing down in Laredo, Texas, to give you some idea of numbers. Have any of you heard of Operation Streamline, that figure? Okay, what Operation Streamline is that's Border Patrol's attempt to, in a designated geographical part of the border, to arrest anybody and for us to charge anybody. They've arrested and detained people for years, and you saw that number at the beginning about the 4.5 million. Most of those people were not prosecuted. They were just told to go back. They were either voluntarily departed or returned or deported, they were just stopped at the bridge and said, turn around and go home. Border Patrol was upset with the fact that they're sending back the same people all the time, back and forth. And we were getting people that were apprehended 10, 15, 20 times over the last period of time, years, and just being told again to go back. And they were feeling like, you know, that's not helping us out. Yes? Those are individual people that were apprehended. That's what I'm...
So it's not double counting anyone that would come back in?
No, that's a separate number. Those are 4.5 discrete million people. Because we have started charging. And when people had a criminal history of maybe five or more prior apprehensions and voluntary returns, we started charging them. And that's what Streamline happened. We began Streamline here in Laredo about... October of last year, so it's been roughly a year. The Laredo division has 170 miles of the Rio Grande River. 60 of those miles are designated streamline parts of the river and the border, wherein if Border Patrol or ICE or any law enforcement person catches anybody that is here unlawfully, we charge the misdemeanor. Now, you've seen what the felony numbers were, and those are obviously more serious cases. Any guess at what, let's say, in year-to-date, from January till today, how many people have been charged with Title 8, Section 1325, a six-month misdemeanor in just that Laredo division in that 60 miles? Any guess?
789,000.
Oh, it ruins my point. No. Only 10,261, and that's through last week, so through Friday of last week, 10,281 people in that 60-mile period, and there's only one checkpoint that gets involved in that. It's the I-35 checkpoint, which is a busy one, but yes.
So you're not talking about people who are charged with an immigration charging document for being present unlawfully in the United States. You're talking about people who are charged with a misdemeanor unlawful entry that you can get 6 months.
Usually don't get 6 months, but it's we charge them there, down there.
They didn't really prosecute people criminally for that, so 10,000 to me is a big number.
No, and we're very busy because of that. I mean, they don't take long to handle. The grand jury doesn't get involved because it's a misdemeanor, and we file just a complaint. And then if we have to, we file a criminal information that says they're just here unlawfully without permission. And the judges are generally sentencing them to about 30 to 60 days. But that gives Border Patrol, the immigration, enough time to deport them thereafter based on that amount of time. They can get their 1A file, or the A file, and send them back. And then there is an official deportation so that if they come back, it's a felony. Just to be here having been deported before without the authority of the Attorney General is how the statute reads. But, yes.
And they are afforded an attorney?
Yes, absolutely. And the public defenders can only, if it's a group, they'll represent a bunch of them, but the private bar down there handles a bunch as well. They're not time consuming. Usually it's a matter of, are you here lawfully or not? Do they have documentation to that, and then the case is over with. But yes, they, in the past, we nor our defense attorneys were even present in some courts when they would get 30 or 40 people at a time and say, okay, you're here illegally, do you understand your rights, do you want to waive them? Because then they were answering yes to everything because they knew immediately they'd be cut loose at that very moment and sent back across. A lot of people, and we figured that's not justice. They need to have advice of counsel, meaningful counsel, and then we need to participate, and we do now. Yes?
Do you know if the people who try to come over here illegally, do they usually try to obtain a legal visa beforehand?
No. Well, I can't say that they didn't try on the other side somehow to get status or to try to come in. Many do that. Most of these folks are economic immigrants, to be honest. They want to come over here, they get a job, they go back home in holidays or Christmas with the money. The number two source of income in Mexico, number one is Pemex, the Petróleos de México, the oil company. company that's owned by Mexico. That's number one in revenue. Number two is money that is sent back from the United States via money orders or wire transfers from people that are working here. Yes?
And once they do have one of these misdemeanors and then they try and get a visa, does that pretty much effectively bar them from ever getting a visa?
Pretty much, yeah. It's not impossible, but it's unlikely, isn't it?
I wouldn't say not ever.
Yeah, but it's unlikely. Not
at least for 10 years, hopefully.
Okay. Yes.
Lula Laredo has captured a lot of media attention right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, of the city, the completely law enforcement, unable to control crime. And has there been any reconsideration of choosing that area at this given time to have Operation Streamline?
No, that actually had nothing to do with it, because most of that violence happens from, some from the smuggling of people, but it's primarily drug cartel related.
And the police, I understand, both at the local level and the federal level, have been unable or whatever to control that, right?
And there has been a notorious degree of corruption among law enforcement as well.
So what do you do when you have, like, the most sympathetic, you know, person that you're prosecuting, and horrible things might have happened to them in the week or two before? You don't have any discretion, right? Prosecutorial.
That, if somebody shows or can prove that they were tortured on the other side, or
I don't know if you call it torture, just some people, I'm understanding currently right now, are coming because of fear.
That, I guess, is realistically possible. It's also a good story to say why you wanted to be here. The violence, as you noticed, also has stayed primarily on that side. We've had some incursions into the U.S.,
but
nothing like what's over there.
Right.
What I can tell you is that will segue into another thing. I spent a great deal of time with Eduardo Medina Mora, who is the Attorney General for Mexico. We've had, literally several days of full-time meetings and talking with, eating meals with, and he and his president are very committed to doing something about the violence, about reducing the corruption among law enforcement, particularly along the border. I mean, you can see the obvious hook. These police officers can get paid more for turning their head to let one load go through than they make in 2 or 3 years of a salary. And then once they do it once, they're sort of owned by the cartel, because then they'll threaten to give them up afterwards. So we're not unmindful of the fact that it's one thing to say, okay, there's a lot of corruption down there. That doesn't solve the issue. It's not. We understand why it happens and are trying to address those causes, including training them on how to do polygraphs of their law enforcement officers. They've actually come into the United States with a cadre of vetted, trustworthy law enforcement people and learned how to give polygraph exams, and they're now required to do that at all levels of law enforcement. And he's committed to that and committed to working with us. Mexico used to think, even at that level of people that wanted to we're good, we're honest, and all that, but they weren't particularly helpful with joint investigations, particularly getting the cartel leaders that were housed either in Mexican jails or in places where the Mexican government knew they were. They didn't think that drug trafficking was a Mexican problem. They now realize that it is. There's an emerging middle class in Mexico, and more people are buying the drugs that are coming through, either from Colombia or Point South, than was the case before. So they have a very real drug problem because of the emergence of the middle class. I drifted off a little bit from your original point.
When you're talking about the border of the U.S. and Mexico, how similarly placed is Canada border and the U.S. in terms of things like these deaths in trucks and
They're the same way. I mean, that border is more porous than the southern border because there just aren't as many agents up there as there are down in South Texas. But historically, most of the problems have been from the south coming north rather than the north coming south. There's been a lot of British Columbia weed that gets sneaked into the country, but there aren't, other than in sort of an Asian population of people that get smuggled in through the northwest, it's just not as much a problem. It's wide open, though, obviously, if somebody wants to come in for nefarious purposes. I guess we're almost done.
I have to let students go because they have classes. So,
all right.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
hands. I know you